From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiatakis with a show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Just outside the large Veterans Affairs campus in West LA, Devin Sessom lives in a homeless shelter.
And which branch were you in?
I was in Army.
Army, okay.
Yeah.
Right now, Devin's talking to KCRW reporter Anna Scott about the various mental and physical health issues that he's dealing with.
Well, not telling you I'm disabled. I'm disabled. My brain's not there no more. My body's not there no more. You know, I can't do as much as I can.
In fact, Devin's been so affected by trauma from his Army service 50 years ago, the VA has deemed him completely disabled by it. It's hard for him to function day to day without a lot of support. Recently, hundreds of new affordable apartments for veterans just like Devin, unhoused and disabled, opened up on the West LA VA campus where he's currently sheltered. But there's one problem. The disability compensation that Devin gets from the VA for PTSD makes his income too high for most of the new housing.
I get tired of always telling me you make too much money for over here.
Now, Devin isn't the only homeless vet in L.A. facing this catch-22. So how did this conundrum come about? And what's the fix? The answers tell you a lot about the red tape around getting into affordable housing all over L.A. KCRW's housing and homelessness reporter, Anna Scott, has the story.
There are a few things you need to know off the bat to understand the dilemma Devin and veterans like him face. First, vets who develop physical or mental disabilities connected to their military service get rated by the VA. Are you 5% disabled, 50%, and so on? The higher the percentage, the higher your compensation. Second, most government-subsidized housing generally comes with strict income limits. You have to make below a certain amount to live in it. So, if you're a disabled veteran trying to get into supportive housing, meaning a subsidized apartment with services and case management,
what happens is this sort of perverse consequence.
John Kuhn runs the VA's homelessness programs in and around Los Angeles.
The people who are the most disabled, 100% service-connected veterans, these are folks who need the help the most, are disqualified in some instances. It's self-defeating.
Someone like Devin, who's single and 100% disabled, could receive as much as $3,600 a month in VA disability compensation. A decent amount of money by any standard, and yet hard to live on in a city where the average rent runs about $2,700 a month. That's according to the website Rent Cafe. Harder still when you're dealing with a disability that makes it hard to function. John Kuhn of the VA says it's not just income restrictions that shut some needy veterans out of supportive housing. There's all kinds of self-defeating rules. For instance, in February, VA officials opened a new building on their West LA campus with 59 affordable apartments. The catch? Tenants had to be over 62, have a history of chronic homelessness, a serious mental illness, and earn less than 30% of the area median income. Hardly anyone fits that description.
We have to find unicorns to fill that building,
yes.
And we have.
But not without a lot of scrambling and financial gymnastics. The affordable housing developer who built the project even returned some funding to the city of LA in order to double the income limit for some of the apartments. In early May, VA officials celebrated the opening of two more long-overdue affordable housing projects with a combined 120 apartments on their West LA campus.
Let's cut those ribbons.
The United States VA Secretary Dennis McDonough flew in from D.C. for the event. And even while celebrating the new housing, he said, yeah, the income thing could make it challenging to fill the new housing.
We're talking with our federal partners about a range of fixes to ensure that we can not let that be an inhibitor to veterans getting into the housing that they need. So I'm not ready to announce a specific fix.
Any fix, McDonough said, would have to involve the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD.
We're working with them now, but under no circumstances should a vet be denied an opportunity simply because that vet's getting the benefits that that vet has earned and so richly deserves.
HUD is the agency that subsidizes the rents at buildings like the new ones at the West LA VA. The simplest fix, according to McDonough and other VA officials, would be for HUD to stop counting disability compensation as income. Officials at HUD, however, say that's not so simple, partly because they want to prioritize the neediest people, which could get tricky if VA disability suddenly didn't count as income, but other disability did. But however they sort it out, this problem is much bigger than a couple of federal agencies squabbling over how to house homeless veterans. It goes to the entire way that affordable housing gets funded in this country. Usually, developers cobble together money from a bunch of public and private funders who each impose different, sometimes clashing requirements. For example, Stephanie Klasky-Gamer with the nonprofit developer LA Family Housing says her organization once built a project for veterans with some funding from the County Department of Mental Health. Sounds good, except when it came time to lease the apartments.
The tenants have to be clients of the county's Department of Mental Health. But it was also a veteran building. And so the vets used the mental health benefits through the VA. They didn't use the mental health benefits through the county DMH.
This isn't unusual. You end up with the tail wagging the dog in a lot of cases because to secure funding, developers end up layering more and more and more restrictions on who can live in their buildings. The consequence? Extra barriers between people in desperate need of homes and safe, affordable, supportive housing. For Devin Sessom, it's scary to think about trying to find an apartment somewhere in LA off the VA campus, away from his doctors and the supportive services he receives.
My medical, I'm afraid of that, about that, you know, because I'm not healthy. I'm 67 years old. I don't know how long I got to go. You know what I mean? It's like I could go at any time here.
He hopes to eventually move into one of the new apartments recently opened at the West LA VA. Though, even if he can qualify, he might run into red tape that makes it hard to move in for other reasons, like getting all the right documentation or waiting for a unit to become available. A month after the U.S. VA secretary cut the ribbon off those 120 new apartments for homeless veterans, most were still empty, waiting to pass final city inspections. While dozens of veterans live in temporary shelters yards away from the new units, by last count, only seven were occupied. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
Well, stories like that are so important. Obviously, we've been covering the homeless issue. We have our reporter, Anna Scott, who covers housing and homelessness and actually did a special podcast called City of Tents that you may have heard through KCRW podcasts. And you know what? Those things are important. We ask for your support of public radio. And this is, by the way, our Save Our Summer campaign. We ask for your support because of programs like that, because of the essential reporting that you get from KCRW, whether it be the news, the culture programs that you get, the music that you get from the radio station. We ask for your support so we can stay strong and healthy through the summer and keep doing what we've always done, which is provide you with that service each and every day. The resources that we need to keep doing what we do have gotten a lot more expensive these days, just like you've probably noticed. Your groceries have gotten more expensive, or rent, gasoline, those kinds of things. Well, it's more expensive for us as well. And thank you for your years of support, but if you can, consider giving monthly, maybe throw in a little extra to match the moment at kcrw.com/give. It is the final stretch of our Save Our Summer pledge drive. We'd really like to get back to business as usual, but hoping that today, by the end of the day, we can get more monthly sustaining memberships, too. And if we can do that, we'll unlock a bonus $300 for KCRW, thanks to the KCRW champion, Murat Sehidoglu. And thank you, Murat, for your support of public radio. KCRW.com/give, and thank you for your continued support. Later on the program, sharks. Where are they? How many are out there? Do they really care about people swimming among them? Turns out there's a lot of research going on. But next, a piece of land in downtown LA that's just sitting there. You're listening to Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you drive or walk around Los Angeles and you pay attention, you'll see them. Vacant lots that remain weirdly empty year after year, sometimes decade after decade. They just sit there, unoccupied, no matter the local real estate market and development scene. One of these properties is in the very heart of downtown LA, where it's been empty for nearly half a century. In recent weeks, the parcel of land has become a bit of an obsession for Saul Gonzalez, the L.A. co-host of the California Report, and, of course, a contributor here at KCRW. And Saul is with us right now. Hi, Saul.
Hey, Steve. It's a real pleasure to be here with you.
All right. Well, why don't you start by telling us more about this property in DTLA?
Okay. Well, picture this, Steve. We're talking about a flat and empty 2-acre property surrounded by high fences and lock gates that's on the corner of First and Broadway. And that puts it like smack dab in LA's Civic Center neighborhood. The lot's right across the street from City Hall, and it's really just a stone's throw from places like the LAPD headquarters, federal and county court buildings, and the music center's just up the hill. So it's really in the middle of everything, at least when it comes to kind of institutional civic LA, right? Now, if you go back in time, there used to be a state office building at this particular location that was built in the 1930s, but it was razed in the 1970s after the Sylmar quake, and the land has just sat there empty and unused ever since. But Steve, there is one thing that you see on the property, these big signs on the corners facing the street that proclaim this message to the people of LA. They say, "Good things are coming," in big letters, exclamation mark.
Good things are coming. So what are these good things? Do we know?
I'm going to tell you. It's a new park for the Civic Center called FAB, or First and Broadway Park. And the signs say it will be an urban oasis with manicured gardens, a public plaza with bleacher seating, these kind of expensive high-tech shade sculptures, and a new 2-story restaurant and cafe complex with a rooftop garden. It's also new green space that would connect to LA County's Grand Park right next door that was recently renamed after the late supervisor Gloria Molina.
All right, so that sounds great. A new city park. What's the problem? Why is it still empty?
Yeah, who would argue with, right? New city park, it's all good. But Steve, yeah. Those signs promising the people of LA that park, they've been up for like 10 years. And now it looks like that promised park won't become a reality, at least not within our lifetimes. And Steve, it's those signs that actually brought me to the story and made it my obsession of recent weeks. Because like a lot of LA residents, I've passed them by for like years, and I've wondered to myself, where's this darn park? Although I haven't used the word darn, I've used more colorful language. Where's this park I've been promised? So I started looking into it.
So that sounds like something that you would do, Saul, for sure.
It's what I do, yeah.
What's the backstory of the park?
Okay, here goes briefly. The city purchased the property from the state of California back in 2013 for about $10, $11 million with the intention of creating a park. It was part of this big, wider program to create like 50 new parks in LA. There was a groundbreaking ceremony. Then an international contest was held to design the park. The winners were a European architectural firm and a local company, Mia Lehrer & Associates, led by Mia Lehrer. And a lot of people know her because she's a rock star in LA landscape design circles and has designed other really big park projects here in the city. The 2-acre park was supposed to cost $28 million and open in 2019, 4 years ago.
4 years ago. And then what happened?
And then nothing, nada, Steve. There's been no progress on the park. The lot remains fenced off and not a single tree or shrub or blade of grass has been planted. And in fact, this year, an internal study by the City of LA Recreation and Parks Department recommended not moving forward on the park project and instead redirecting available funds to other park projects like the redesign of Pershing Square.
So, what happened, Saul? How and why exactly was such a high-profile project abandoned?
Okay, don't get mad at me, because I wish I could actually answer that question more comprehensively. I approached the Recreation and Parks Department, that's the lead agency in the project. They didn't get back to me with answers. I approached Kevin DeLeon's office. He's the city council member in whose district this parcel of land is located. They didn't get back to me. I approached Mia Lair, the landscape architect's office, who got the winning bid to create the park. They didn't get back to me. But, Steve, I did talk to Stephen Sharp. He's the editor-in-chief of the planning and real estate website Urbanize LA. Sharp's really done the most coverage on the park project over the years. He says there might be two reasons for why this park is in kind of suspended animation. First, its one-time champion, former LA City Councilman Jose Huizar. Well, he pled guilty to corruption charges, so he's out of the picture. When Huizar left, the park became kind of an orphan project. Second, the costs for the park's completion started to mount, particularly during the pandemic. Here's Stephen Sharp of Urbanize LA talking about that.
They were not far away from having enough money before the pandemic, but as construction costs and material costs just kind of skyrocketed in the last few years, that, you know, what was a little bit of a budget gap became a budget chasm. And which is kind of why they've just decided to put it on hold for the time being, just because they're nowhere near being able to get the money for this thing.
So, Saul, where are we now? What's it going to take to get this done, or will it ever get done?
Well, we really don't know, Steve. I mean, it's supposed to cost $28 million. The city says it doesn't have $28 million to complete the park. My question would be, could we do something a bit more modest in scale? Does it have to have a two-story restaurant and cafe complex, for example, and maybe have pop-up restaurants or a coffee cart? I just don't know those answers. Here's what I do know, Steve. Those signs are still up there promising a park to the people of Los Angeles. And that park looks like, at least as of right now, it isn't going to happen.
California Report's Saul Gonzalez reporting for us. Saul, thanks.
Hey, as always, a pleasure, Steve. Thanks so much.
More of Greater LA Now on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Even if the thermometer and skies don't say it, the calendar says summer is nearly here and maybe the beach is in your future. And in those waters, just offshore, dwells some toothy treachery. Cue the cliche music, Phil. I'm not here to scare you about sharks, although you should be very careful out there. And neither is our guest, who says those sharks have always been there. Christopher Lowe is a professor over at Cal State Long Beach and director of their Shark Lab. Welcome, Christopher.
Thanks for having me.
Shark Lab. Tell us a little bit about it. It seems like a wild concept to me. How did you decide that sharks needed so much study that there is actually a lab?
Well, actually, the Shark Lab has been at Cal State Long Beach since 1966. It's one of the oldest shark research labs in the country. And I took over in 1998, and I was even a grad student back in the shark lab back in the late 80s.
What got you into sharks in the first place? You surfer? You like being in the water?
Well, coincidentally, I grew up in Martha's Vineyard where they shot Jaws, and I love to fish and dive. And, I caught a shark one day, and that was my hook. Got me into it.
Well, that was a pun worthy of even me. So you caught a shark. What was that like?
I love fishing. I fished every day growing up. And I remember one day catching this weird animal. I didn't know what it was. I hadn't caught one before. And I was a horrible student. And it actually made me go to the library to look up what this thing was. And I found a book on sharks. And that was it.
I mentioned this new study that you have out now. Tell us a little bit about what you found, because when I say, and that this study says that there are sharks and there have always been sharks out at sea, and there are probably more than you think, what does that all mean?
Yeah. So, as scientists, we have been kind of clued in the fact that there are sharks out there and they're probably around people all the time. We just didn't have any way of measuring that. And for the first time, using drone technology, we actually had the ability to measure how many times people and sharks were together in the water at the same time. And, I always joke with people who said, look, if you spend any time in the water, I guarantee a white shark's swam by you in California. You just didn't know it. Well, now with the drone technology, we were actually surprised at how often juvenile white sharks swim right by surfers and swimmers. And it's literally many, many times a day. As I'm speaking to you, there's probably a juvenile white shark swimming underneath the surfer.
And is that dangerous?
So that was our initial concern, right? So in 2018, we were funded by the state of California to start the Shark Beach Safety Program. And one of our goals was to address this concern about the growing white shark population and all these sharks that are occurring off our beaches. So what we've learned is that juvenile white sharks use our beaches as nursery. It's a safe place with lots of food and warm water. And it just so happens that people use those areas for the exact same reason. So one of the things that we've noticed was that these sharks have particular places where they like to hang out. And in some of those places, there are lots of people, and others, not so many. But what we were originally thinking was that having all those people nearby would scare the sharks away. Turns out it doesn't. Sharks basically have just learned to ignore people.
Ignore people, though. But I mean, when I looked at a statistic that said California was, I think, what, ranked third in shark attacks in the country? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, they're not really ignoring people sometimes, right?
Well, exactly. Every once in a while, people do get bitten. But what we always have to remind people is, look, you have a better chances of winning Powerball than you do of being bitten by a white shark in California.
So if you're in the water, you're surfing, you're just waiting in the, you know, in the lovely Pacific Ocean, right? You're there. What do you do to avoid? I mean, if they're ignoring you, do you just keep in your mind, well, they don't care that I'm here? Or do you do something to not irritate them in their habitat?
So that's an interesting question. And one of the things that we noticed from our study was that most of the time when we could see sharks around people, people couldn't see the sharks. So basically, they weren't reacting to them. So, you know, what we're curious about is, because these sharks show up when they're very young as babies, what if they're learning to identify us? What if they're learning that that's the sound and smell of a swimmer? That's the sound and smell of a surfer. And then later, as they get bigger, one of the reasons why we think sharks may occasionally bite people is they mistake us for prey. They mistake us for a seal or a sea lion. What if they're learning how to identify us and now can do that because they've been exposed to us at these nurseries? We might have fewer bites in the future because of accidents.
So what do you do if you encounter a shark or one is near you? Do you panic? Do you obviously don't panic, but what do you do?
Well, we always tell people, look, if you see a shark, the shark kind of wanted you to see it. So what we always tell people is, look, if you see it, keep your eyes on it. Let the shark know you see it. So if you're on a surfboard and you see a shark, move your surfboard to track that shark. Let the shark know it's being seen. And for many of these animals, that's their MO, is their goal is to sneak up on things and try to identify what it is and determine whether it's food. So if the shark knows you know it's there, the gig is up.
So you're trying to figure out, like, what it is that people are doing in the water that would elicit some sort of response from a shark, right?
Well, what we're trying to measure is who's out there and what are they doing? And then can we ask, is what they're doing getting a shark's attention? And if it doesn't, does that mean the shark is now knows what that is and just learns to ignore it? So imagine if you live by the 405 and people ask you, hey, do you hear that traffic? And people say, what traffic? So they've become so attuned to it that they blank it out. So that's one of the things we think could be happening with many of these sharks. They're so used to this sound of people in the water near them that they tone it out.
Like white noise.
Just becomes white noise. They've habituated
great,
to it.
Great white noise.
Exactly.
All right. Professor Christopher Lowe, director of the Cal State Long Beach Shark Lab. Thanks for coming on and talking with us today.
Thank you. Great to have me.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, a new bill that aims to have the state of California build more mixed-income housing, what's called social housing, which keeps rents affordable by eliminating profit motives. How will that look in L.A.? That's tomorrow on GLA. Today, in a few more days, we're tapping you for some extra love during our Save Our Summer fundraising campaign. How about upping your monthly gift to help us out? We wouldn't ask if it weren't a priority if we didn't feel a big squeeze this year with our costs increasing at levels that we haven't seen before. Give now at kcrw.com/give. give. If you give monthly at the $20 level, how about a special gift? A couple of limited edition lip balms, Cherry Glazer, and Morning Becomes Matcha from XO, an LA-based maker of clean and ethical flavored lip balms. And thank you for your support. KCRW.com/give. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all help put the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time and your attention. Have a great night.